Welcome. It is Tuesday, August 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Vice President Joe Biden hits the campaign trail with Hillary Clinton.
Trump's ideas are not only profoundly wrong, they're very dangerous, and they're very un-American.
More protests follow a police shooting in the Midwest city of Milwaukee. Extreme weather, get used to it. Also ahead, an update on the Summer Games. It's all on today's International Edition. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump on Monday in a foreign policy speech in the Midwestern battleground state of Ohio said the United States needs to align itself with any country, regardless of past disputes, that wants to defeat radical Islamic terrorism. He said the rise of Islamic State is the direct result of foreign affairs policies advocated by President Obama and his first-term Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton.
Incident after incident proves again and again Hillary Clinton lacks the judgment, as said by Bernie Sanders, stability and temperament and the moral character to lead our nation.
Well, if elected, Trump said the era of nation building for the U.S. will come to a swift and decisive end. Meanwhile, rival Hillary Clinton campaigned Monday in Scranton, Pennsylvania, appearing alongside Vice President Joe Biden in the working-class city where he was born. Biden also contended that no major party nominee in the history of the United States has ever been less prepared to deal with our national security than Donald Trump.
Someone who lacks this judgment cannot be trusted. There's a guy that follows me right back here, has the nuclear codes. So, God forbid anything happened to the president and I had to make a decision. The codes are with me all. He is not qualified to know the code.
Let's talk more about Trump and Clinton's campaign speeches today and where the campaigns stand with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, what did we learn from the candidate speeches?
The big speech of the day was Donald Trump's remarks in Youngstown, Ohio, laying forth a national security plan. The real focus here was on tightening up immigration policy. Nothing new here in the sense that Trump has talked about this quite a bit. He may have added a few more layers of detail, talked about extreme vetting of immigrants coming in, questioning them about ideology, this kind of thing. So it adds another layer of detail in one sense, but also he could be vulnerable to criticism on another for kind of pursuing this line of thinking, which has gotten some criticism in the past, especially his Muslim ban, which he didn't directly address today in the context of these remarks. But at the same time, we had Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, the vice president, campaigning in another key election state, Pennsylvania. Basically, their argument there was about Donald Trump's temperament and not putting the case forward that they don't believe his temperament is fit for him to be president. And so we've really now crystallized, I think, the strategy here. The Democrats, Hillary Clinton, they want to make it so that the voters see Trump is unfit to be president. On the Republican side, I think there's an element of fear and insecurity they want to emphasize, that as long as we continue under the Obama policies, and if Clinton were to win, we would be vulnerable to attacks from ISIS.
Well, speaking of vulnerability, Vice President Biden also pointed out that the terror group Hezbollah was using Donald Trump's own statements about President Obama in their own message. That has to be a little worrisome.
Yeah, he was referring to last week's claims by Trump that Obama and Clinton were the founders of ISIS. Now, Trump did not say that in so many words on Monday, though he did lay blame for the rise of ISIS at the policies of the Obama administration, including, of course, the work of Secretary of State Clinton. But Biden warned in Pennsylvania that that could make, for example, U.S. troops in the region vulnerable, more vulnerable than otherwise, because now, adversaries are picking up the rhetoric of Donald Trump.
Overall, how is the race looking for a while there? It was neck and neck, but it seems as though in recent weeks since the Democratic convention, Hillary Clinton has pulled ahead quite a bit.
Yes, she's ahead. The national polls show an average of about 8-point percentage lead for Clinton over Trump. I think more disturbingly for Trump and the Republicans, if you look at individual key, what we call battleground or swing states, she has some sizable leads in some surprising places, in Virginia, in Colorado, in New Hampshire. All of those are what we call swing states, could go either way in the election. Even in North Carolina, a state that President Obama won once, but not in 2012, she has a sizable 9-point lead, according to recent polls. If this trend continues, it's going to be bad news for Trump, not just with voters generally, but within his own Republican Party. They may decide to start to emphasize congressional races and pull away from him. Now, it's still a little early for that, but I think we're at a critical stage in the campaign, and it's surprising at the moment how strong Clinton's lead is. Doesn't mean that she is not still vulnerable to attack, and we'll see where this week goes. But I think a lot of Republicans are nervous about where the Trump campaign is headed at the moment.
All right. We appreciate it. Thanks so much. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Now let's take a look at what people are saying on social media about Trump's speech with G. Abby Lee. Hi, G. Joining me here live in studio. What are people saying?
Hi, Lori. Let's begin with Donald Trump's statement on Facebook. Shortly after his foreign policy speech, his team posted its full transcript, and they captioned it in all caps, "Today I address radical Islam and the age of terror from Youngstown State University." You know they mean business when they write in all caps. The top comment to that post reads like this: "America first. Way to go, Trump. Trump is spot on and 100% right. We must stop radical Islamic terrorism. America." Trump is the only real leader who recognizes this disease. Terrorism has definitely crossed our nation's red line, and it must be eradicated now. And then it goes on for a while, but ends with, "Make America safe again." Another person wrote, "Radical Islam is real, and our country is in grave danger right now." And as you can see, those comments are from Donald Trump's Facebook page, and written by his supporters, but from the people who don't support him, let's turn to the New York Times. Trump actually criticized earlier this month for New York Times reporters for not knowing, quote-unquote, how to write good. And many media outlets were fascinated with his grammar and reported on it. The New York Times wrote this on its Facebook page: "Donald Trump's plan calls for immigrants to answer a questionnaire about their comment to basic principles of tolerance," a policy advisor said. The top comment to that post reads like this: "I think before they vote, Trump supporters should answer a questionnaire regarding their knowledge of the alphabet. And no, alcohol, beer, and cigarettes do not count." That was a little mean.
That is mean. Anything else?
Well, on Twitter, a tweet by MSNBC's legal correspondent Ari Melber wrote one of the trending tweets in Twitter Moments. Keep in mind, though, MSNBC is widely thought of as a left-leaning broadcaster. Ari tweeted, "Trump says 9/11, Boston, Orlando attacks all involve immigrants or children of immigrants. That huge category is 37% of U.S. residents." That's all for me today. Back to you.
All right. Thank you so much. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We appreciate it. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the top stories we're following in Asia. Japanese Prime Minister again skips a visit to a controversial war shrine. Identity of the Thai bombing suspects, a source of intense speculation. Afghan officials see foreign fighters playing a key role in the Helmand fighting. Bangladesh tries to move a stranded elephant to a safari park. And the South Korea's leader vows strength on issues of national security. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The Midwestern U.S. city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, saw a second night of unrest with police in riot gear confronting a group of people protesting the killing of a black man by police. But there was no repeat of the widespread destruction of property that occurred Saturday when at least six businesses were torched and destroyed. Milwaukee-based journalist Bonnie Petrie with public radio station WUWM went to the scene on Sunday, joining me now to describe what she saw. Hi, Bonnie.
By the time I got there, the crowds had dispersed, but there were, you know, there are people that live in the area around there. And when I pulled up and parked, so many people were still on their front porches. You know, it was very late. But as soon as they saw a reporter, they sort of went into their houses. I did approach some people to talk, but they didn't want to talk to the media. They were obviously and understandably shaken up by the events that had happened in their neighborhood throughout the evening. I mean, this tension had been building over a period of about 10 hours, starting at around 3:30 in the afternoon, and really didn't explode in violence until after night fell. And then walking around the area where the main, you could fairly call them riots, occurred, there were three buildings in about a 2 to 3 block radius that were burned out, glass all over the streets, very strong police presence in the area, and firefighters obviously still working to make sure that no hot spots would burst into flame. But when I was there, and as is the situation now, things were pretty calm.
Police are saying that body cams showed that the man did in fact have a gun. But we're hearing that maybe this is all something that has been brewing for a while, that there's been a much deeper simmering anger.
There is. In that particular, the north side of the city, that particular neighborhood, Milwaukee is, by many accounts, the most segregated city in America. And I think a lot of people are surprised to hear that. A study that was released earlier this month by 24/7 Wall Street indicates that, in fact, the state of Wisconsin is the worst place in America for black Americans to live. And that particular neighborhood is rife with hopelessness and frustration and simmering anger. And then in the 24-hour period preceding what occurred with the police officer, there were 9 fatal shootings. The neighborhood is frustrated. It's dangerous, and people are stressed and don't feel like their concerns are being heard. Racism is a real problem in Milwaukee, and yeah, I think this has been building for a while.
City Alderman Khalif Rainey said it was a powder keg for potential violence, that he's not justifying it, but that it's just the worst place for African Americans to live in the entire country, just pretty much what you said.
It is, and I heard him say that. And he said it with quite a bit of passion. And you could hear in his voice and see in his eyes his frustration, his feeling of hopelessness came across when he spoke last night and made the statement to which you're referring. This is not as a journalist, but as sort of a citizen of the area and a human being, my first reaction was, the only thing surprising about this is it didn't happen sooner.
So inequities, injustice, unemployment, undereducation, that's some of the things
that
he said is just a byproduct. This is a byproduct of all of that.
Yeah, those are my thoughts and many expert opinions on the situation in Milwaukee. I mean, you know, the mayor touched on that today at the news conference I covered. You know, something's got to give. Something's got to give. There's got to be some development in those particular zip codes, some hope, some jobs, improved schools. There's a whole laundry list of things that could and should be done. I moved here after almost 15 years in Texas and was absolutely shocked, because one of the first things people tell you when you move to the area is this is a very segregated city, or this is a city that has serious problems with racism, and everybody knows it. And nobody's really exactly figured what to do about it.
You know, police are saying that it was a black police officer as well that shot the
right.
the black man.
Yeah, they didn't release many details. He's apparently staying with family now. He's apparently received some threats and has some concerns about his safety. So they didn't release his name or anything beyond the fact, which was an answer to a direct question that he is an African-American police officer.
Well, if there's anything good that we've heard from this story, it's that people came out voluntarily to clean up the community.
And you know what? That doesn't surprise me at all either. I routinely go into those zip codes to cover stories, and I've never felt anything but warmth and wide open welcome whenever I go in to cover stories in the neighborhood. There, it's full of good people. And so when I saw that there were over 100 people in Sherman Park gathering to, that didn't surprise me a bit.
What are local officials doing now to try to prevent this from happening again this evening and beyond?
The police are all working extra shifts, and everybody's working. Everybody's on guard, the National Guard, the Wisconsin National Guard, is at the ready. I think everybody's a little bit nervous, but hopefully it remains peaceful and we don't have another night like last night, tonight, or ever again. This is a very tense time across the country, as we know, with officer-involved shootings and then shootings of police officers. You know, I think this has been a pretty tense summer. I think most people would agree. I think that may also be a part of that.
Well, we appreciate your perspective. Reporter Bonnie Petrie in Milwaukee. This is VOA.
The political party convention is a critical part of the American electoral process. VOA correspondents are there, reporting the latest developments.
Jim Malone, VOA News in Cleveland.
Katherine Gibson in Cleveland, VOA News.
Tune in to VOA's extensive, up-to-the-minute coverage of the U.S. presidential election.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London. We're glad you could be with us. Thousands of people in southern Louisiana hunkered down in shelters on Monday, forced out of their homes by intense flooding that took many people by surprise. The weather had improved from the torrential downpours, but rivers and creeks in many areas were still way above flood stage. Heavy rain in some areas came close to 2 feet over a 48-hour period. Rescuers evacuated more than 20,000 people since the flooding started on Friday. At least 6 people were killed. Resident Jay Woods in the town of Abbeville describes the situation.
Where I work, there's a side street. There is a little river that connects to, it's called the Vermilion River, and it's completely flooded. It's flooded out the road. We have customers coming in on actual boats and air mattresses to the store to get supplies.
Well, with a flooding emergency in the south, extreme heat in the east, and wildfires raging in the west, could we be getting a preview of the planet's new normal? I talked about it with Dr. John Abraham, a climate scientist and professor of thermal and fluid sciences at the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering in Minnesota, what we can expect in the years to come.
Yeah, it is. So one of the things people often think about with global warming is the Earth is just going to warm gradually over time. But actually, what's more important is that it's going to become more volatile. And what that means is when severe weather happens, it's going to happen in a bigger, badder way. So it means rains are heavier, resulting flooding is heavier. Heat waves will come on faster and stay longer. And so it's this swinging of weather from one extreme to the other that is symptomatic of our changing climate.
Do you expect that we will continue to see more severe weather and it will get worse? Or is this just sort of how this is just the new normal? Or what are scientists saying?
Well, this is not the new normal. The new normal is going to be worse. What this is a window toward what normal weather will be like in the future. And the extremes that we have now will be dwarfed by the extremes that we have in the future. So it tells us what's going to happen in the future because these extremes are becoming more prevalent, but they will get far worse as time goes on.
Even possible to reverse this at this point?
It is impossible to reverse it, but it is possible to do something that will make it less harmful. Human decisions will create a climate that is either really challenging or a nuisance that we can adapt to. And right now, we're on the trajectory to make it a really, really challenging environment and a challenging climate. But if we can increase renewable clean energy production, if we can use the current energy more wisely, and if we can be better stewards of the planet, we can actually get off the business-as-usual path, and we can get on a path that will have less harmful effects. And people may say, well, does it really matter that much which pathway we're on? And the answer is yes. It is just looking at economics. We will save far more money. Forget people dying, crops dying, but just in terms of dollars, we'll save more money by taking action now that reduce these influences in the future. It's just a common sense. It's common sense to get off our current pathway.
Right. Obviously, they're using all their resources in California dealing with wildfires and Louisiana dealing with flooding. Air conditioners are on overtime here on the East Coast, so that's all costly.
It is costly, and it's costly in terms of energy, but it's costly in terms of damage. I mean, if you're in California, if you're the agricultural sector in California is an enormous contributor to the economy. And when you have a prevalent severe drought like the one we're currently in, that's going to be a huge drag on the economy. We've had the terrible droughts. There was a terrible drought in 2011 in Texas and Oklahoma that cost $6 billion. There was another huge drought in the Midwest in 2012. It cost about $40 billion. So these things cost real dollars. I mean, this isn't just, it's hot, I got to turn on my air conditioner, I got to pay more electricity. These are huge costs that affect many systems of our economy. And that's one of the reasons why scientists are so concerned.
That was Dr. John Abraham, professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. We appreciate it. You've been listening to International Edition. We're glad you could be here with us. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jim Harmon. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A living nightmare is how Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken described life for religious and ethnic minorities in Iraq and Syria under the barbarous genocidal regime of Daesh. Speaking at a Washington conference on the threat posed to these communities, Mr. Blinken said there is grave concern over their very survival. He noted, however, that the global coalition's momentum against Daesh is growing and has led to a significant liberation of territory held by the terrorist group, a cut in their financing, a diminution of the flow of their foreign fighter recruits, and the elimination of thousands of their leaders. But more needs to be done. Iraqi forces, he said, are preparing for the greatest battle against Daesh to date, the liberation of the Iraqi city of Mosul and the surrounding Nineveh plains. Deputy Secretary Blinken stressed that the twin responsibilities of military victory and inclusive political and economic progress must proceed together in lockstep. Mr. Blinken noted that Mosul holds a unique place in Iraqi history and identity. For thousands of years, Christians, Yazidis, Turkmen, Sunni, Shabak, Kurds, Shia, all have made this ancient city their home. He called the area the cradle of civilization, rich in ancient cultural artifacts, but most importantly, representative of Iraq's cultural infrastructure of pluralism and diversity. He emphasized the importance of the Iraqi government's providing a fundamental accommodation in which all of Iraq's communities believe they have a future in Iraq.
All Iraqis, be they Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Christian, or any other, have to be convinced that the state that they've been asked to fight for, the state they've been asked to remain a part of, will stand up for their rights and their equities, that they can advance their interests more effectively as citizens of a united Iraq than as supplicants of other regional powers or members of isolated competitive blocs in a fractured and weakened state.
Deputy Secretary Blinken observed that the real wealth of a nation is defined not by its size or military prowess, but by its human resources. Countries that invest in the health, in the prosperity, in the security, in the diversities of their societies will thrive in the 21st century. That is the future. And with international assistance, it is the future, Deputy Secretary Blinken said, that the Iraqis can make possible for their communities and for their country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.